This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Check, check, check. Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you, no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women who have put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom. And we don't want to forget that. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure are educated, we're entertained, and a whole lot of times we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We're going to get a story today from a gentleman who just turned 94, John Wagenhals of Sanger, California, but originally from a lot colder climate. What was the name of your hometown in Montana?
Glasgow, Montana.
Just like Scotland, but probably not as many people, huh?
Not as many people, but a lot colder.
What do you think the population of Glasgow was when you were growing up?
1,500, I would imagine. And I don't think it's a lot more right now. The younger people usually leave. Most of them go to college, actually, that come out of the high school. And of course, after they finish college, there's nothing really up there for them. So they leave, they go somewhere else.
And this is almost to the Canadian border, far northeastern Montana. How cold would it get when you were growing up there? What's the coldest you remember?
The coldest I remember is 60 degrees below zero.
What does that feel like?
Feels cold.
Does that feel like being at 20,000 feet in a B-17?
Yeah, even colder than that. And not only that, the summertime gets up around 110 or 115. So it was quite a spread of temperature, you know, from the hot to the cold all in 1 year's time, you know, go from 60 below to like about 110 above. So it's quite extreme.
Did you come from a big family? Were you an only child? Tell me about your family growing up and what you did to keep yourself busy in Glasgow, Montana.
I had two sisters and two brothers. While I was growing up, my dad was a tailor. He didn't make much money, you know, so we lived poor, I would say. When I was old enough, I started selling papers. And I'd get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, go peddle my papers, and then go to school.
And you wanted to move to the coast, or how did you end up in California?
You know, I really don't know. The only thing I can think, maybe, there was a large dam being built at Fort Peck, which was right out of Glasgow, and I had a motorcycle. And there was another guy that was from Van Nuys, California, and he had a motorcycle. And so the dam finished, and he left. And then I thought, well, if I want to go to California, I ought to maybe contact him. So I did. I contacted him. He says, yeah, come on down, you know. And he was a single guy. He was living in a house with a couple other guys. And so I went down there, and then I applied for a job at Lockheed in Burbank, I guess it was, and also applied for a job in San Diego, Consolidated Aircraft. They called first. So I moved to San Diego, and I was there helping them build the B-24 airplanes.
Where were you when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor? And do you remember how you found out about that?
I was living in San Diego at the time, and I was on my way to work, actually, on the bus. And somebody said, first I'd heard about it, but it probably had happened hours before, that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor. But that was the first time that I had heard about it, and I was on the way to work.
Well, I imagine there was quite a buzz at work about that, considering what your work was.
I don't think we got a lot done, actually, at work. We did more talking than working. So anyway, it was scary at that time because they kept talking about, well, they're going to bomb the West Coast. So we were worried about that, of course. And so anyway, it was a different time right after they bombed. You know, the lights went out. You know, all the windows were closed and the shades were pulled, and you couldn't do anything outside, you know, hardly at night, which would require any light. So it was a different time altogether, that's for sure.
Did you have any inkling at that point that it was going to change your life and what you would be doing before long?
I had no idea. I hadn't ever thought about the military, to tell you the truth. Never thought about it. I didn't think I'd ever want to do that. I probably wouldn't have if it hadn't been for the Air Force. If it just been plain old Army, that didn't appeal to me at all.
It would have been plain old Army if you didn't do something about it. And I'm just putting the pieces together. And I don't know if I've ever interviewed anyone that worked on B-24s in a factory, flew in B-17s and B-29s, but before he got into the Army Air Corps was working in a shipyard in Vallejo. That's quite the versatile repertoire we've got going there. How did you end up in the shipyard?
When I was at San Diego working in the aircraft factory, I didn't like it. I was working in what they call a drop hammer department, and it was so noisy. Oh, I mean, just terrible noisy. So I wanted to get out of there. So I applied for a job at Vallejo Shipyard. And so it wasn't long. I got a call from them. They said, yeah, we have a job for you here. We'll expect you to come up in a week or so or whatever it was and get settled in. I said, okay, fine, I'll be there. So I got out of the drop hammer department, which was so noisy. But I didn't really want to leave San Diego because it was so nice. But that's what you have to do.
Well, I think you're pretty thankful now that you left San Diego because there was something pretty important that happened in Vallejo, right?
Oh, yeah. Yes, of course, I met my future wife there. We had 65 years together. We had two kids, you know, and so it's been a good life. It's been a good life. We did a lot of things, you know, and I've enjoyed it, and I have no regrets.
I've seen the wedding photos and see how happy you and Marie looked on that day, but do you remember how she first caught your eye? What was that that first moment that you said, hey, this one's pretty special?
Yeah, the first time I saw her, she was in a white uniform, which all the waitresses had on at the cafeteria. We were the single men and the others that were living in this barracks sort of situation. She was there, and I ordered a piece of cherry pie. And she brought it over, and I thought, geez, how pretty. How pretty. I'd like to know that girl. So anyway, she brought me the pie. The pie was 10 cents, and I left her a 25-cent tip. And that was a big hit for her.
Guys, are you listening? He just gave you the secret. But you didn't get married till you got back from overseas?
That's right, yeah. We were engaged before I went overseas, and then we waited. You know, I didn't know what was going to happen while I was over there. So we thought we would wait, and when I came home, we got married. I was home for a week or so before we got married. And then she went with me to the next bases. And we lived together, you know, on the basis.
But there was quite a bit you had to survive in order to come home to marry her. And then we better get the story of how you ended up in the Air Corps, because you got word from Montana that they were going to draft you. And you didn't want that to be the way it went down, huh?
No, I didn't want to be a gunslinger or whatever you want to call those guys, you know, and crawling around on the ground. That just did not appeal to me. So I thought, well, I'm going to get into the Air Force. A little later, I found out, you know, about the Aviation Cadet Program. Up to about that time, you had to have at least two years of college before you could get into the cadet program. And so then they opened it up. If you could pass a certain test, you could get into the program. I took classes to learn kind of about what they were going to be wanting to know on the test. And so I took the test and then was admitted as a cadet. But because of the backlog of people, it was about 3 months from the time I was enlisted until I actually got into uniform, because they just didn't have space for the people. And then from then on, you know, aviation cadet program, it lasted about 3 months or 4 months on the basics of military and so forth. After that came the bombardier school.
Were you hoping to be a pilot when you went in?
Oh, yeah, sure.
And probably everybody was, right?
Yeah, everybody was. And they had the classification where you were classified either bombardier, navigator, or pilot, or all three, or two, or whatever. And most of us qualified for all three. But then it depended on what their needs were at that time, whether you would go to pilot school, bombardier school, or whatever. So the Germans had kind of changed their method of attack. It used to be a kind of a tail-end attack coming in from the back, or coming in from a kind of a quarterback to head-on. And then when the head-on started coming, that's when they started losing the bombardiers. And so that's why they had such a shortage. And so so many of us that went in at the same time ended up in bombardier school. So it was okay.
Well, it can't be very encouraging, though, if you find out, well, the reason we need bombardiers is because they sit in the nose and they're getting shot by all the German fighters. What were you getting yourself into there?
We knew what was going on, but it wouldn't happen to us. You know, it would be the next guy that was going to get shot down, not us.
And you ended up flying more than 30 missions in B-17s during World War II. In fact, if folks are driving up Highway 99 in Central California, they go past Mefford Field in Tulare. The B-17 there has the markings of your 379th Bomb Group and a big K for Kim Bolton, England. But was there anything between starting and getting to that base in England that got your attention, or an interesting experience along the way before you even got overseas?
The most interesting part was meeting all these people from all over the United States. You know, they were just everybody, and they were all so nice. All these young guys, you know, like myself, and we were all close together because we were confined to barracks, and whatever we did, we always did it as a group. And I got to know some of the greatest people that I've ever known, and I hope they're still alive and doing well, too. But that was, I think that was about the most interesting and important thing that I learned, you know, was to how to associate with all these nice people. It was really good. I enjoyed it.
And I've talked to some guys who flew with the same crew on the vast majority of their missions, and other guys who, just because of timing and everything, ended up with five or six different pilots and different crew members. How was it for you? Did you have the same crew for most of what you did?
Yes, we did. We had the same airplane for most of what we had. When we first got there in England, we had flown an airplane over from the United States to England, but they were going to do some modifications on it, so that did not become our airplane for our combat flying. We flew, I think, three missions in three different airplanes to start, and then the fourth mission, I think it was, we flew in an airplane that somebody had named Busy Baby, and so we finished flying all of our missions in that one airplane, and we all stuck together. We all survived, you know, nobody actually got hurt. We got shot up, you know, plenty, but everybody survived in pretty good shape, physically and mentally.
That first mission, were there some nerves for you? Was there some adrenaline pumping? Because, I mean, I know you've practiced and you've had all this training, but really you've never done that before, right?
That's right. And, you know, we knew they were losing a lot of airplanes and losing a lot of people, and airplanes were getting shot up pretty bad, and they're coming in with one engine out or two engines out. And so, you know, worried about it, you know. So anyway, we took off. We were flying towards the mission. We got towards the target, probably on what we'd call the bomb run, which is probably about 15 miles ahead of the target. And we could see them shooting at us, but they were quite some distance away. They weren't very accurate at the time. They were low. They were not very good, tell you the truth, at shooting at us, and we were thankful for that. So then in my mind, I thought, well, what's the big deal here? This is a piece of cake. So we got through that one fine. I went back, and I said, yeah, you is. That's okay. We're going to get through this in fine shape. Well, the next mission was Berlin. That was a different story. They must have been 1,000 guns aimed at us, you know, up there. And it was, all of us were going, a whole Air Force, I think, was going to Berlin, but we had different targets in Berlin. We would fly, and they would throw up the anti-aircraft in sort of a box formation that they knew we were going to have to fly through to get to the target. And they would just keep pumping it up into that box. And then when it got farther along, they would move the box towards the target. And, I mean, airplanes were going down like crazy, you know, so it was really bad. So that scared the hell out of me.
Well, yeah, and you're probably the guy that has the worst position on the plane for that because, I mean, a guy in the tail or at the waist gun, he doesn't see it all coming. But you're right there in the nose, and you see it all before you have to fly through it, right?
You see it, and you wonder how you're going to get through it, you know, because, I mean, it's thick. It just almost obliterates the view. You know, from the explosion of the shells, you know, large 88s. You just can't imagine being able to fly through that. And then at the same time, you can see, well, this guy's dropping out. He's got some problem. Or this guy's going down. This guy's on fire. You know, and it's that kind of thing all the way along there for a good 30 minutes probably before you get to the bomb run. And they kind of leave you alone during the bomb run because they don't want to get shot down either, you know, for that matter. So, and then the fighters that were coming in. So, and then after you finish, you drop your bombs and you get out of the way, they're back after you again. So it's a never-ending thing, it seemed like, for a while. Especially during the first part of my tour over there, when we had fighter escort would take us about halfway to the targets. Then the other halfway, you're on your own, you know, just the bombers and the stream of bombers. So there was enough bombers that it provided a certain amount of protection, you know, but they were going down pretty fast.
And I'm sure there's some moments in all those missions that you wondered if you were going to bring that plane in. I want to ak you, though, since we're on the topic of flak and you just described that moment before you enter that box, as you described it, of all the flak, what are you doing? I mean, are you bracing yourself? Are you closing your eyes and clenching your teeth? Are you saying a prayer? What in the world are you doing?
I'm looking for the target, really. Actually, yeah. That's what happens, yeah. So you're looking for the target to see where it is, and you start looking for your points of interest that you can find along the way that helps guide you to the target as you're looking, you know, because it's too far away to actually see the target at that point. But you can line up on the other things that you know where they are, which are in line with the target. You see that, and then you see all this flak, and you say, oh, my God, how am I ever going to get through this? You know, and it's incredible. It's incredible. It's a wonder anybody survived.
Especially when you know you have to just stay on course and stay in formation. And maybe some of our listeners don't know that when you start that bomb run, it's not the pilot who's controlling the airplane anymore, right?
That's right, yeah. And there's no deviation. You get on course, and you stay on course, regardless of what's coming up at you. You just keep on going, because once you set your sight for the target, you're locked in. And that's where it has to be.
And you, as the bombardier, are now in charge of the plane and responsible for that 10-man crew, right?
Yeah, it's actually the bomb sight, using the bomb sight and making corrections in the bomb sight, which turns the airplane. And so it'll turn the airplane left or right, but the elevation is up to the pilot. He's got to keep the altitude at the right height. If he deviates a couple hundred feet, that throws the bombs way off the target. So he's got to do that, and he's got to be good at that too.
And when it comes to those bombs being on target, I know there's a strategic import, obviously, of hitting the right spot that you were assigned to hit. But I wonder too, for you, just as a human being, and you're, what, 23, 24 years old at this point?
I think I was 22 or 23.
I mean, how much responsibility did you feel to hit the right target, knowing that the wrong target might take out civilians or might do some damage that certainly you weren't intending to do?
Well, you want to hit the right target, and you want to take it out, because if you don't, it means coming back again the next day. So you might as well get that over with. And as far as damage to the civilian population, you just can't let that bother you. That's war. That's all there is to it, you know. If you let that bother you, you'd just go absolutely nuts, I would imagine. So I know there were a lot of people killed by our bombs.
Well, and I just wonder, as you describe that, is that the understanding of someone who's 94 and flew more than 80 missions between World War II and Korea compared to maybe that 24-year-old flying his first bomb mission? Did it take you a while to arrive at that? Was it hard to get to that point emotionally?
Yeah, I think so. Even at the beginning, though, we knew that other people would get hurt besides those that are in the target area. And not every bomb hit the target, you know, that's for sure. So there was a lot of corollary damage done, which included homes, houses, hospitals, office buildings, anything. But that was just part of it, you know. We didn't have the laser type aiming situation that they have now, where they could, you know, just aim right at it and away it goes. That's it. So we didn't have that.
Did you have the Norden bomb sight, or was that before this?
We had the Norden bomb sight, which was good, but at 25,000 feet, which was mostly where we were flying, I would say a good strike would be within 200 feet of the target. That would be good. And so most cases we would accomplish that. But sometimes there were times when they hit the wrong target. You know, it's something that might look like the same. But in most cases, I think it was fairly effective considering the equipment we had to work with.
Well, it's time for our first break, but we're just getting started with 94-year-old John Wagenhals, a veteran of World War II and the Korean War. When we come back, what was it really like in the nose of a B-17? And before we're done, his close calls in B-29s as well. More of Hometown Heroes right after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.